One section of the roof was raised half a story above the other. A dozen determined students held out here, throwing folding chairs, bricks, and roof tiles. For a few last seconds, their silhouettes were etched in heroic silliness against the sky. The paved Kuro Gu courtyard had been turned into a gravel patch by the battle. Inside the building, the air was a mud of smoke and gas. Fires were still burning in some corners, and water from the fire hoses ran in rivulets down the stairs. The police were making the students carry out their wounded. Several were unconscious, and one girl, wrapped in a blanket, had a hand's breadth of skull laid open and a bad, bloodless look to her face. The students were swollen and red from the gas. They stumbled around, dazed and stupid. The cops were gathering them in Kuro Gu's larger rooms, making them prostrate themselves, obeisant like Muslims in prayer, but more tightly hunched, children trying to make themselves disappear. These balled-up figures were packed into perfect squares of 100. The grabbers strolled over every now and then and gave the kids a few kicks for good measure. The building had been fought over inch by inch. Every stick of furniture was destroyed. Every breakable thing was broken. This was Korea, however. The bathrooms were still spotless. About 100 hostages, including several children, were released. They looked thoroughly sick. Nobody seemed interested in them. According to the next day's official report, 24 policemen and 40 students were seriously injured. 1,005 students and student-allied radicals were led away. The captured students were made to elephant walk down the stairs and into the courtyard, bodies bowed double, one hand on the waistband of the student ahead. Kicks and swats hurried them along. I noticed the dog-faced girl stumbling by, with glasses missing and a big shiner. Then the mommy riot began. A dozen middle-aged women arrived at the police lines. They shoved their plump bodies against the riot shields and screeched, "You murderers!" and "Where is my son?" and "I hate this country!" Then they fell into brief faints, tore their hair, wept, screeched some more, and went into other histrionics, enough for a French actress on a farewell tour. This is better than my mother would have behaved. She would have been there yelling, "Keep the bum!" That night, the journalists who'd covered the Kuro Gu riot, having showered and dumped our gas-soaked clothing in hotel hallways, had a long, well-lubricated dinner. Between the blowing of gas-scalded noses and the wiping of gas-curried eyes, we discussed Korean democracy. As I recall, the discussion went something like this. "What the fuck? Beats the shit out of me. Yo, waitress, more whiskey." When the dinner was over, I went with two photographers, Greg Davis and Tom Haley, for a little constitutional up the hill to Myeongdong Cathedral, a few blocks from the restaurant. About 100 students with the usual rock piles and firebombs were sitting in up there for no reason anyone was very clear about. The students had blocked the street on the hilltop in front of the church and weren't going to let us through. "Democracy, free press," said Davis as we flashed our credentials.
"No free press,"
shouted student number 30. They'd all given themselves numbers, which they wore pinned to their chests.
"No democracy," said Davis.
"No democracy,"
shouted 30.
Then, out of the gloom, appeared a pair of American preppies, he in tweeds and a necktie, she in a demure loden coat.
"Hi,"
the boy said brightly. "We're from the International Human Rights Law Group. We're here to observe Korean democracy."
"Ask number 30 about that," said Davis.
Down at the bottom of the hill, riot police were forming up, shield to shield, grenade launchers loaded.
"Yeah, you little fuck," I said to number 30. "What do you think about getting democratically hammered about half a minute from now?"
The members of the International Human Rights Law Group gasped to hear someone speaking to a genuine Korean like that, right in the middle of Korea's first presidential elections in 16 years. But then they caught a look at the advancing police. The law group took off like surprised mice. Haley, Davis, and I were too slow. We could hear the grenades being fired, half a dozen of them. Ka-chunk, chunk, 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 chunk.
"Incoming!"
yelled Haley, the last thing he'd be able to say for half an hour. The grenades burst just above our heads. We ran screaming down an alley, slamming into walls and garbage cans, coughing and gagging, a scum of tears running down our sightless faces.
After 200 yards, we collapsed, bent over in pained hacking and gasps. A group of Korean men, earnestly merry with drink, were coming up the other way. They stopped in front of our little spectacle. The lead fellow bowed and said,
"You Americans, yes, what do you think about Korean democracy?"
said Haley. But the Koreans were not making a joke.
"What do you think about Korean democracy?"
said their leader, gravely.
"That tastes terrible," said Davis.
They hustled us into a storefront cafe and bought us a great many large bottles of OB beer. We sat there sneezing and weeping and coughing. They sat there asking,
"What do you think about Korean democracy?"
That turned out to be all the English they knew.
Panama Banal, July 1987. Panama has the damnedest anti-government protesters. They're all dressed up in neckties or linen dirndl skirts and driving around in BMWs and Jeep Wagoneers, honking horns and waving white hankies out the windows. Opposition HQ is that infamous center of treachery and sedition worldwide, the Chamber of Commerce building. A national civilian crusade has been formed from more than 100 trade associations and charity ball-type organizations. Everybody is full of moral indignation, also civic boosterism. Cruzada Civilista Nacional demonstrations take place before luncheon and at the cocktail hour along Calle 50, Panama City's main artery for the shop-till-you-drop set. It's like watching your mom and dad riot at the mall. White is the opposition color, appropriately enough. Less affluent Panamanians, who tend to have more black and Indian blood, call the opposition Rabe Blancos, white butts. The Rabes, who've soiled their handkerchiefs, wave white business stationery in pages torn from month-at-a-glance calendars. Office towers are festooned with white adding machine tape streamers. White 3x5 index cards flutter from the windows, and white confetti is made with document shredders. This is only the second known use, after Fawn Halls, of the shredding machine in the fight for democracy. Protest signs are done with computer graphics and slogans displayed on word processor printouts. In the better residential neighborhoods, the noon and 6 p.m. demos are marked by children, housewives, and kitchen help banging on pots and pans. At least one enterprising member of the opposition is selling a pot-banging cassette, so dinner won't be late. There are no sweaty marches or boring sit-ins. When the opposition wants to stage a mass rally, it calls for a white caravan, and everyone drives through town with the air conditioning on. If people can't make it, they send the maid. This is genius, to use littering, noisemaking, and traffic jams as political protest in a Latin country. Think how quickly we would have been out of Vietnam if golf, commuting, and watching Mayberry RFD had been anti-war in the United States. A full-blown civilian crusade shindig musters 8 to 10,000 people, but a government-sponsored whoop-up can draw as many or more. The pro-government types, who more or less support military strongman General Manuel Antonio Noriega, are fatter, have worse teeth, and wear more polyester. Their Panamanian flag-draped Caravanos Patrióticos are filled with Japanese economy cars. It's not really rich versus poor. It's more like the Elks versus the Rotary Club. The dentists and bank tellers are mad at the meter maids and postal clerks. I couldn't always tell them apart. On my first day covering the Panama shenanigans, I saw a phalanx of riot police, or Dobermans, as they affectionately call themselves. Nearby was a group of neatly dressed business-like folk holding bundles of leaflets. I rushed up to them and said, "Is this the anti-government demonstration?" "We are the government," replied one in a huff. They were members of the national legislature. The government cheats a bit with its anti-demonstration demonstrations, handing out gas money and giving public employees the day off, then taking roll call at the rally. During a week of ceremonies marking the anniversary of the 1981 death of national hero General Omar Torrijos, the government staged a wonderfully named Carnival of National Dignity. There were a half dozen salsa and merengue bands and free beer and firecrackers for everyone. Not all of the pro-government sentiment is manufactured, however. When gringo reporters are spotted, loyalist crowd members yell complaints that they aren't getting their share of U.S. press coverage.
"You must print pictures of this!"
Several people shouted at me, although I wasn't carrying a camera. And one large and beery lady, more full of political spirit than political savvy, leaned halfway out of her car window and shrieked,
"This proves Panama does not want communism!"
Seeing that the basic conflict in Panama pits right-wing businessmen against a right-wing military, I guess it doesn't. Sometimes a white caravan and a pro-government caravan get going at the same time, circling around the city like students from rival high schools before a big football game. The pro-government bunch are more willing to mix it up. They're the kids from Central High downtown. The opposition, suburban souls whose real strength is in the tennis team, tend to yell clever things and skedaddle. I saw one pro-government caravan led by a stakebed truck full of drunks come across a snazzy black Toyota Supra with a white flag hanging from the window. The drunks let loose at the Supra with slingshots. The Supra driver tried to make a U-turn, but before he could get his car around, four or five of the drunks leapt off the truck and smashed his windshield with a rock the size of a Thanksgiving turkey. The Supra made a rubber-peeling escape. A volley of stones followed him. So did I, in my rental car. I wanted a pithy quote. I was sticking my head out the window, flashing my lights and screaming, "Prensa Internacional! Prensa Internacional!" But the guy was doing 80 miles an hour through side streets, and the last thing I saw was his white flag being tossed onto a lawn. The college kids are demonstrating, too. They claim to be opposed to the government and the opposition and the United States, too. The schools have been closed, so there aren't that many students around, only about 200 at the demonstration I saw. Still, they put on the best show. The students chanted, "Noriega fucks whores," and blocked a four-lane highway in front of the University of Panama with piles of flaming garbage. One no-neck in a highway department truck ran the blockade, and the students, who had been hoarding rocks and chunks of cement, scored 30 direct hits on his truck. Hundreds of locals deserted offices and factories to gather on pedestrian overpasses and watch the fun. When three platoons of soldiers arrived, the students hightailed it like a clutter of cats back inside the university gates. They have a great system in Latin America. The college campuses are recognized sanctuaries, and soldiers and police aren't supposed to set foot on the grounds. Of course, every now and then, the authorities get overexcited and break the rules and kill people, but usually the tradition is respected. After a brief regrouping, the students ran up to the chain-link fence that surrounds the campus and threw rocks and bottles. Then the soldiers ran up to their side of the fence and blasted at the students with shotguns. It was rednecks hunting quail through the hedge at the bird preserve. Most of the shotgun shells were low-power loads filled with size 7.5 shot, tiny stuff that wouldn't kill you unless it went right up your nose. Though I did pick up a couple of high brass shells that held enough powder to take off a hand or a face. The soldiers also threw pepper gas canisters and fired pepper gas rifle grenades into the campus, sometimes making the mistake of low trajectory, which let the students grab the grenades before they exploded and tossed them back. There was a lot of quarterback talent on both sides. The students were sending 2- and 3-pound projectiles on 80-yard TD bombs, and there was one tall black corporal who made John Elway look like a sissy throwing rice at a wedding. The students set fire to a car, though not a very good one. My guess is it belonged to a professor who liked to give surprise quizzes. During a lull in the action, I managed to slip into the school with an NBC camera crew. The campus was fogged with gas. Students brought us buckets of vinegar. Apparently, vinegar is the only specific against the pepper fumes, but it's a toss which hurts worse when you get it in your eyes. An entire medical dispensary had been set up in a lecture hall, complete with volunteer nurses and space for a press conference. We talked to a dozen or so injured students. One kid had at least 15 pellets in his back and side. He was very crabby. We had some trouble getting back out again, until the military finally decided that very few rioting students are 40 years old, fat, carrying 50 pounds of video equipment, and frantically hollering, "Prensa Internacional!" A few minutes later, a commotion of pro-student pot-banging broke out in a high-rise across the highway from the university. The soldiers happily turned their shotguns on the apartment building.
A man in a bathing suit was standing on one of the balconies. He yelled at me, in English, "They're shooting at the fucking building!"
I yelled back, "For Christ's sake, get inside!"
Panamanians are not particularly brave people. Even Roberto Duran wound up holding his tummy and going, "No mas, no mas." And one of the soldiers had lettered this bellicose statement on his helmet cover, "Rambo, terror of civilians." But no Panamanian can resist an opportunity for self-dramatization. The fellow in the bathing suit didn't budge.
"Tell Reagan we got a great fucking democracy going here," he shouted.
What, you may well wonder, is all this about? I mean, here we've got a country that two-thirds of America thinks is a hat. Actually, the hats are made in Ecuador. And damn it, we can't be expected to stay up to speed on every one of these third-world pissing contests. Crazy greasers. They've always got bees in their pantyhose about something. We gave them their silly canal back. Now what's the matter? Well, fat, pock-faced General Manuel Pineapple Head Noriega is nobody's candidate for the Medal of Freedom. Panama is a military dictatorship covered by a thin scum of constitutional formalities. And the pineapple reigns over the Panamanian Defense Force, which includes the army, police, and several kinds of plainclothes thugs. There is virtually no such thing as conflict of interest under Panamanian law. Senior military officers and their relatives sit on the boards of nearly every corporation and control most government contracts. According to U.S. Embassy sources, Noriega has several large houses in Panama and property in the south of France. At his daughter's wedding, guests were served pink champagne with pictures of the bride and groom on the labels and Baccarat crystal party favors. If Ugly Mug is living within his modest army salary, he's a better money manager than I am. There are other juicier allegations. Noriega and Ilk probably pulled the 1985 torture murder of a government critic named Dr. Hugo Spatafora. Panama is a country more greedy than evil. Snuffing your badmouthers is not considered the small social gaffe it is in most of Latin America. You're supposed to send them off in exile to the Valley of the Fallen, Miami Beach. The U.S. Justice Department is also investigating Noriega's use of Panama as a huge drug money laundromat. Furthermore, defected Cuban intelligence big shot Major Florentino Aspayaga says Noriega has been raking in dough selling U.S. high-tech items to Castro. The opposition has a point. They would prefer nice, stable, democratic corruption, like we have in the United States. But unfortunately for the cause of kick-out-the-wheel-chocks partisan journalism, the pro-government people also have a point. Panama used to be run by the normal south of the Rio Grande kitty litter box of brain-dead hacienda owners and United Fruit business squad. Then, in 1968, General Omar Torrijos led an army-backed coup. Torrijos was a half-baked socialist and a blowhard, but he was lovable and good-looking. He took a predictable, feisty underdog stance toward the U.S. and the local rich shitepokes, swearing he would fight all of them in a guerrilla war if he had to, which he knew he didn't. Panamanians, who have absolutely no immunity to theatrics, went nuts over Omar. Actually, he was sort of an all-right guy. He had genuine feeling for the poor, started some only moderately useless social programs, and maintained a modest style of life, keeping no more than two or three mistresses on the side. Torrijos also managed, after decades of negotiations, to wrest a new canal treaty from the United States. Admittedly, he wrested it from Jimmy Carter, so it isn't like he played against the varsity, but it gave the Panamanians a patriotic thrill to get the middle of their country back. And under Torrijos, though to a certain extent despite him, Panama prospered. It became a middle-class country with one of the highest per capita incomes in Latin America. Thousands of jobs were added to the government payroll. People came up in the world. "Even the men who killed Torrijos loved him," a taxi driver told me. Taxi drivers all over the world, by the way, are under Newspaper Guild contract to give easy quotes to foreign correspondents. In fact, nobody killed Torrijos. He died of his macho penchant for flying in bad weather. But such is the romance in the Panamanian soul that nothing will do except he be a martyr. When Torrijos bought the rancho, Noriega, his chief of staff, was the natural heir. Watching him try to act like Omar is like watching Ted Kennedy try to act like Jack. Members of Noriega's own government admit he's a pig. But a lot of people are scared the Rabe Blancos will bring back the bad old days of venal oligarchy. This is unlikely because most of the opposition belongs to the new middle class, but that's politics for you. Also, what's the big deal about corruption? This is Panama, for God's sake. The whole country is a put-up job, sleezed into existence by Teddy Roosevelt so he'd have someplace to put the big ditch. One pro-Noriega legislator told me, in a fit of candor about peculation, "We are just doing the same thing the others were doing from 1903. The Panamanian government types are also mad about the U.S. Senate resolution of June 26, 1987, in which the Panamanians were advised their democracy had B.O. and they'd better send Noriega to the showers with a family-sized bar of Dial. Part of the resolution was in language identical to an opposition manifesto. And how would we like it if the French Chamber of Deputies voted for a Democratic Party policy statement telling everybody in America to listen up when Mario Cuomo speaks? Then the United States trotted out the State Department's Human Rights Bureau, that feeble Carter administration leftover, and sent one of its goody-two-shoes human rights investigators to pester the natives. How about a Saudi Arabian human rights investigator arriving uninvited in D.C.?
"By Muhammad, you are not cutting off enough hands of thieves. You are not throwing off of minarets enough adulteresses. You are not branding your slaves on their bottoms."
We'd appreciate that. So, although the opposition has a point, the government has a point too. And the college students? Well, the college students don't have a point. They're just mouthing the standard third world college student takeout order. Two anti-colonialisms, an anti-capitalism with cheese, and a small shay on the side. The students are full of shit. That, however, puts them in perfect harmony with the nation of Panama. The whole country is full of shit. Or, since they're very nice people, let's say the Panamanians have a poetic conception of the truth. The opposition movement was set off by anti-Noriega accusations from Colonel Roberto Diaz Herrera, who was forced to resign as the Defense Force's second-in-command. Not exactly an unbiased source. Diaz claimed, among other things, that Noriega and the ex-chief of the U.S. Southern Command, the hopelessly respectable General Wallace Nutting, planted a bomb on Torrijos's plane after, get this, luring it off course by changing satellite navigational signals. Diaz Herrera also underwent some kind of religious conversion, then barricaded himself in his walled suburban mansion with the teaching of his spiritual guru and a gang of armed supporters. He was all but receiving Radio Venus on his bridge work when the government finally stormed his house and hauled him off. Various eyewitnesses to the attack on Diaz's house told me there were 5 dead bodies on the lawn, told me there were 8 dead bodies on the lawn, told me Diaz's only son was killed, told me Diaz himself was killed, etc. Diaz has several sons, none of whom were killed, nor was Diaz. Indeed, the 90-minute firefight at the Diaz home didn't kill or seriously injure anyone, a very Panamanian touch. Another witness told me Sandinista troops participated in the battle, dressed as Dobermans. Assorted tales from the government camp were just as silly. The government press office circulated subliterate books and pamphlets claiming that the pre-coup president, Arnulfo Arias, murdered Jews, and that the Jewish Eisenman family, which owns the principal opposition newspaper, is running an international cocaine ring. This is Radio Bemba, lip radio, and it is, after money, cars, and Japanese stereo equipment, the ruling passion of Panama. During 1 hour in a discotheque, I heard the following nonsense. 1. Noriega has picked every Miss Panama since he took over and deflowers each of them. 2. The last Miss Panama had to be married off to one of Noriega's colonels at the insistence of Noriega's jealous wife. 3. Mrs. Noriega killed her husband's mistress when the mistress was 6 months pregnant. 4. A pregnant woman was shot by the Dobermans when they mistook the diaper she was hanging on a clothesline for a white opposition flag. 5. Werewolves are loose in the Panamanian countryside. Of course, an important part of Radio Bemba is blaming absolutely everything on the United States. The opposition tells you the U.S. isn't supporting them because Noriega is a tool of the CIA, usually right after they've told you Noriega is in the pay of Danny Ortega.
The government tells you the opposition is controlled by the U.S. Embassy DCM, John F. Maestro, because he used to be in Manila, where he overthrew Marcos. And the college students tell you all sorts of things very loudly in Spanish while shaking empty pepper gas canisters under your nose. In this case, the students do have a point. Triple Chaser Grenade, Federal Laboratories, Salzburg, Pennsylvania, read the canister labels. I don't know about you, but it makes me sleep better at night, knowing the U.S. Defense Department keeps our allies supplied with these. Why, if Panama should ever have to come to our aid in a war against Russia, the Panamanians could just fill the air with pepper gas and make the Soviet Air Force pilots sneeze like the Dickens. 3,000 words here, and it seems I still haven't answered the question. What's happening in Panama? Darn these Apple IIs, anyway. Where's the brief, insightful summary key on this thing? The Rabi Blancos are acting like wimps. When the government moved on Diaz Herrera and simultaneously closed all the opposition newspapers, opposition leaders responded by hiding. Pro-Noriega salsa bands took over the streets. On July 26th, after nearly 2 months of agita, somebody finally got killed. A quiet, well-behaved business administration student named Eduardo Enrique Carrera. Eduardo and some friends apparently yelled, "Down with the pineapple," at a police cruiser, and the police shot him. Not a single major opposition leader showed at the funeral. As for the Rabi Blanco demonstrations, I was talking to a senior official in the Panamanian Foreign Ministry, a black guy whose grandparents came from Jamaica. He just laughed.
"Man, I went to the toughest high school in Panama City," he said. "We knew how to riot. Oh, these people should check the confetti in Beirut."
On the other side, the government hacks are acting like morons. They're swamped with debt, but spending millions on pep rallies and early bonuses for public employees. Reuters correspondent Tom Brown, the only U.S. reporter based full-time in Panama, was expelled for reporting a civilian crusade general strike as 85% effective. "You have 24 hours to leave the country voluntarily," Brown was told. And on June 30th, the government launched what might be the lamest ever spontaneous attack on an American embassy. 5,000 government workers were required to participate in the demonstration in order to receive their paychecks. These not very enthusiastic anti-imperialists were bussed to the embassy compound, where cheerleaders led them in dispirited chants while 30 hoodlums threw rocks at the building. Washington presented a bill for $106,000 in damages to the Panamanian government, which promptly apologized and paid up. Meanwhile, the economy of Panama goes to hell. It's not like they make or grow anything. The whole country is based on international banking and a canal the United States can take back any time it wants with one troop of Boy Scouts. Right now, the contents of Panama's banks are on a greenback salmon run to Luxembourg, the Bahamas, and the Cayman Islands. Noriega's getting to be more troubled than he's worth to the other corrupt military officers. He'll probably retire in favor of some more acceptable general. Or maybe he'll hang on. The opposition might even win, and its 100 factions will squabble merrily until the next coup. People knowledgeable in Panamanian political affairs ask themselves, who gives a shit? The night before I left, I watched an NBC producer who'd been in the country for 2 months sit on the floor of his hotel room drunk, swaying and keening to himself over and over again.
"The rumors, the honking, the confetti, the tear gas. The rumors, the honking, the confetti, the tear gas."
Panama can drive you around the bend. Believe me, I know. I went back to my room and put on my best Central Intelligence Agency seersucker jacket and reptie. Then I went down to the hotel bar to leave the Panamanians with a little of their own radio bemba, a sort of going-away present.
"Buenas noches, Ramon," I said, speaking to the unctuous bartender in a stentorian American voice. "Looks like those rich Rabe Blancos are too scared to get their own hands dirty."
"Sí, como no," Ramon agreed.
"You know, I was up at Southern Command today," I said, looking around as though we might be overheard. "I hear the Robbies are hiring some out-of-work death squad guys from Argentina." I leaned over and whispered loudly to Ramon. "And they're getting help from the Mossad, MI5, and the KGB. Then I downed my drink and smiled,
knowing the news would be all over Panama by morning. Third World Driving Hints and Tips. During the past couple years, I've had to do my share of driving in the Third World, in Mexico, Lebanon, the Philippines, Cyprus, El Salvador, Africa, and Italy. Italy is not technically part of the Third World, but no one has told the Italians. I don't pretend to be an expert, but I have been making notes. Maybe these notes will be useful to readers who are planning to do something really stupid with their Hertz No. 1 Club cards. Road hazards. What would be a road hazard any place else in the Third World is probably the road. There are two techniques for coping with this. One is to drive very fast so your wheels get on top of the ruts and your car sails over the ditches and gullies. Predictably, this will result in disaster. The other technique is to drive very slow. This will also result in disaster. No matter how slowly you drive into a 10-foot hole, you're still going to get hurt. You'll find the locals themselves can't make up their minds. Either they drive at 2 miles per hour, which they do every time there's absolutely no way to get around them, or else they drive at 100 miles per hour, which they do coming right at you when you finally get a chance to pass the guy going 2 miles per hour. Basic information. It's important to have your facts straight before you begin piloting a car around an underdeveloped country. For instance, which side of the road do they drive on? This is easy. They drive on your side. That is, you can depend on it. Any oncoming traffic will be on your side of the road. Also, how do you translate kilometers into miles? Most people don't know this, but 1 kilometer equals 10 miles exactly. True, a kilometer is only 62% of a mile, but if something is 100 kilometers away, read that as 1,000 miles, because the roads are 620% worse than anything you've ever seen. And when you see a 50-kilometer-per-hour speed limit, you might as well figure that means 500 miles per hour, because nobody cares. The Third World does not have Broderick Crawford and the Highway Patrol. Outside the cities, it doesn't have any police at all. Law enforcement is in the hands of the army, and soldiers, if they feel like it, will shoot you no matter what speed you're going. Traffic signs and signals. Most developing nations use international traffic symbols. Americans may find themselves perplexed by road signs that look like Boy Scout merit badges and by such things as an iguana silhouette with a red diagonal bar across it. Don't worry. The natives don't know what they mean either. The natives do, however, have an elaborate set of signals used to convey information to the traffic around them. For example, if you're trying to pass someone and he blinks his left turn signal, it means go ahead. Either that or it means a large truck is coming around the bend and you'll get killed if you try. You'll find out in a moment. Signaling is further complicated by festive decorations found on many vehicles. It can be hard to tell a hazard flasher from a string of Christmas tree lights wrapped around the bumper, and brake lights can easily be confused with a dozen red Jesus statuettes and the 10 stuffed animals with blinking eyes on the package shelf. Dangerous curves. Dangerous curves are marked, at least in Christian lands, by white wooden crosses, positioned to make the curves even more dangerous. These crosses are memorials to people who've died in traffic accidents, and they give a rough statistical indication of how much trouble you're likely to have at that spot in the road. Thus, when you come through a curve in a full power slide and are suddenly confronted with a veritable forest of crucifixes, you know you're dead. Learning to drive like a native. It's important to understand that in the Third World, most driving is done with the horn, or Egyptian brake pedal, as it is known. There is a precise and complicated etiquette of horn use. Honk your horn only under the following circumstances. 1. When anything blocks the road. 2. When anything doesn't. 3. When anything might. 4. At red lights. 5. At green lights. 6. At all other times. Roadblocks. One thing you can count on in Third World countries is trouble. There's always some uprising, coup, or Marxist insurrection going on, and this means military roadblocks.
There are two kinds of military roadblocks, the kind where you slow down so they can look you over, and the kind where you come to a full stop so they can steal your luggage. The important thing is that you must never stop at the slowdown kind of roadblock. If you stop, they'll think you're a terrorist about to attack them, and they'll shoot you. And you must always stop at the full stop kind of roadblock. If you just slow down, they'll think you're a terrorist about to attack them, and they'll shoot you. How do you tell the difference between the two kinds of roadblocks? Here's the fun part. You can't! The terrorists, of course, have roadblocks of their own. They always make you stop, sometimes with landmines. Animals in the right of way. As a rule of thumb, you should slow down for donkeys, speed up for goats, and stop for cows. Donkeys will get out of your way eventually, and so will pedestrians. But never actually stop for either of them, or they'll take advantage, especially the pedestrians. If you stop in the middle of a crowd of third-world pedestrians, you'll be there buying chiclets and bogus antiquities for days. Drive like hell through the goats. It's almost impossible to hit a goat. On the other hand, it's almost impossible not to hit a cow. Cows are immune to horn honking, shouting, swats with sticks, and taps on the hind quarters with the bumper. The only thing you can do to make a cow move is swerve to avoid it, which will make the cow move in front of you with lightning speed. Actually, the most dangerous animals are the chickens. In the United States, when you see a ball roll into the street, you hit your brakes because you know the next thing you'll see is a kid chasing it. In the third world, it's not balls the kids are chasing, but chickens. Are they practicing punt returns with a leghorn, dribbling it, playing stick hen? I don't know, but third-worlders are remarkably fond of their chickens, and also their children, population problems notwithstanding. If you hit one or both, they may survive, but you will not. Accidents. Never look where you're going. You'll only scare yourself. Nonetheless, try to avoid collisions. There are bound to be more people in that bus, truck, or even on that moped than there are in your car. At best, you'll be screamed deaf. And if the police do happen to be around, standard procedure is to throw everyone in jail, regardless of fault. This is done to forestall blood feuds, which are a popular hobby in many of these places. Remember, the American consul is very busy fretting about that Marxist insurrection, and it may be months before he comes to visit. If you do have an accident, the only thing to do is go on the offensive. Throw big wads of American money at everyone. And hope for the best. Safety tips. One nice thing about the third world, you don't have to fasten your safety belt, or stop smoking, or cut down on saturated fats. It takes a lot off your mind when average life expectancy is 45 minutes. What do they do for fun in Warsaw? May 1986. Usually, a plane ride gives me some distance on questions of dogma, the way a martini or a lungful of hashish does. We don't call it high for nothing. That was slang 3 centuries before the Wright brothers. Whatever those microbes down there think is no concern of mine, unless I fly into the Soviet bloc. Something's wrong when harebrained ideas can be spotted from Olympian heights. On the outskirts of Warsaw, the whole countryside is scarred with the gravel pits and gray dust plumes of cement factories. Commies love concrete. Commies love concrete, but they don't know how to make it. Concrete is a mixture of cement, gravel, and straw? No. Gravel, water, and wood pulp? Water, potatoes, and lard. The concrete runway at Warsaw's Minzadara Nowe Airport is coming to pieces. From bumpy landing until bumpy takeoff, you spend your time in Poland looking at bad concrete. Everything is made of it. Streets, buildings, floors, walls, ceilings, roofs, window frames, lampposts, statues, benches, plus some of the food, I think. The concrete that hasn't cracked or flaked has crumbled completely. Generations of age and decay seem to be taking place before your eyes. Yet, all of this is new. The Poles rebelled against Nazi occupation in 1945, and the Germans, in their German way, dynamited Warsaw house by house. Some stumps of churches and museums survived, but nothing major in the central city is older than Candace Bergen. And the place is dirty with a special kind of Marxist dirt. I've seen it before in Moscow, Rostov, and East Berlin. It doesn't reek like the compost heap squalor of Mexico City. It isn't flung all over the place like the exuberant trash of New York. There's no litter. There isn't much to litter with. It's an orderly and uniform kind of dirt, a film of dry grit and slough on everything, and an atmosphere lachrymose with diesel stink and lignite coal smoke. I got into an airport taxi, and the driver came right to the point.
Do you want to change dollars?
The Polish zloty is an animal tranquilizer on the international currency market. Even the official exchange rate is enormous, 163 zlotys to $1. Dinner at the best restaurant in Warsaw costs only 3,000 zlotys. A streetcar ride is 3 zlotys.
I'll give you 500 to 1, said the driver.
How much is the fare? I asked.
Business is business, he said. The cab ride is free.
I handed him 10 twenties, made myself rich, and tried to go shopping. The Polish communists have done their dimball best to recapture something of the pre-war Warsaw style. That is to say, not every building looks like a parking garage. And the Russian-type Stalin's wedding cake architecture is absent except for the huge palace of culture and science, a gift from the Soviet people, which everyone execrates. But there was only so much they could do with bad materials and worse sense. And they seem to have built the city from broad-shouldered, quick-breeding new masses who never showed up. Meanwhile, a sparse stand-in population rattles around, tired-looking, tending to middle age, not completely clean. There's too much room on the sidewalks and in the vast public squares. The farty little East German Wartburg cars and dinky Polish-built Fiats are at sea on the huge boulevards. Warsaw is empty, but not silent. Too many trucks and buses are missing their mufflers, and the ill-machined wheels of the streetcars squeal on the badly laid rails. The place sounds and smells more like a lonely freight yard than a capital city. I found the three main department stores, Wars, Sawa, and Junior, next to each other on Marszałkowski Street, the main drag. They had a little neon on their signs, which was a relief. Lack of advertising leaves a weird hole in the urban landscape. You think, what could be uglier than billboards? But have you ever looked behind them? In communist countries, you don't get to see the giant pictures of the cars, boats, and pretty faces that fill people's dreams. You just see the people and where they live. Each department store had the look of a small-town five-and-dime a few months after the new mall opened out on the highway. Except they don't have malls here, or many highways either. The merchandise in all three was identical. Pants, coats, blouses, and jackets were badly stitched and lumpy and cut like Barbie and Ken clothes blown up to life size. Everything was made of imitation polyester, if there is such a thing. Muddy purples and cheap sky blues predominated, the kind of colors you see when anti-nuclear activists try to dress up. The mannequins had hems falling down and collar points awry and lint in their synthetic hair. The houseware section was filled with nasty little glass tchotchkes and disposable-looking aluminum skillets and pans. The toys were fat, pad-faced dolls and sagging, truck-shaped doodads made from plastic Americans wouldn't use for the bags the toys came in. The only interesting things I saw were the appliances, and the only interesting thing about them was that I couldn't tell the stoves from the washing machines or the washing machines from the refrigerators. There's a joke in Poland about shopping, as there's a joke about everything. A woman sends her husband to buy meat for dinner. He stands in line for 6 hours at the butcher shop, and then the butcher comes outside and says there's no more meat. The man explodes. He shouts,
"I am a worker. I am a veteran. All my life I have fought and toiled for socialism. Now you tell me there's no more meat? This system is stupid. It's crazy. It stinks."
A big fellow in a trench coat comes out of the crowd and puts his arm around the man's shoulder.
"Comrade, comrade," says the fellow in the trench coat, "control yourself. Do not go on so. You know what would have happened in the old days if you had talked like this."
And the fellow in the trench coat pantomimes with a finger at his temple.
"So please, comrade, calm down."
The man goes home empty-handed. His wife says,
"What's the matter? Are they out of meat?"
"Worse than that," says the man. "They're out of bullets."
I crossed Marszałkowski Street to a row of small private shops rented from the government. The first shop had a single shirt in the display case. The second had 5 hair ribbons and a lady's hat from the Jack and Jackie White House era. But in front of the third shop, 20 or 30 people were gathered, gawking at something in the window. I elbowed into the crowd and pushed my way to the front. They were looking at plumbing fixtures. I had 100,000 zlotys in my pocket, more than some Poles make in 6 months. I finally bought a hot dog. I suppose it was no worse than an American hot dog. Horrible things go into hot dogs, but in this hot dog, you could taste them all. When I was applying for my Polish visa, I didn't know what to tell the people at the consulate. I couldn't very well say I was doing a story on, does 30 years of involuntary Marxism make folks nuts or what? The press officer wanted to see a copy of Rolling Stone, the publication I work for, so I told him I was doing a piece on Polish rock and roll. There actually is such a thing, if anybody cares. Poles themselves would rather listen to The Clash and Bob Dylan. But this fib got me press credentials so I could go to news conferences in Warsaw and listen to the Polish government do the modifier bop. It takes a lot of adjectives and adverbs to give the Marxist side of the news. The official Polish press agency is called, no joke, PAP. Here's an excerpt from one of their releases. Wojciech Jaruzelski and Gustav Husak stated concordantly that Poland and Czechoslovakia attach essential importance to the further deepening of the relations of friendship and cooperation between the two countries, based on the principles of Marxist-Leninism and socialist internationalism, the consolidation of fraternal ties with the USSR, cooperation within the political defensive alliance of the Warsaw Treaty, you get the idea. At the first press conference I attended, government spokesman Jerzy Urban was refuting some statement on long-term effects of Chernobyl fallout.
"False erroneous news," said Urban, "due to a general psychosis which is being established in the West."
An American reporter asked him, rather gleefully, "How's the blanket collection going?" Poland had volunteered to donate 5,000 sleeping bags to New York City's homeless. But so far, only 500 sleeping bags had been found in the country, and only one had been donated by a private individual. The American reporter wanted to know if there wasn't something strange about donations to the homeless from a country where so many people wanted to leave home. Everyone in the room, including Jerzy Urban, tittered. The person next to me whispered,
"A classified ad ran in the Warsaw papers. We'll exchange 2-bedroom apartment in Warsaw for sleeping bag in New York."
The American reporter quoted Lech Wałęsa as saying, "If the borders of Poland are ever opened, will the last person out please turn off the lights and close the windows?" Urban laughed at that too and said Wałęsa could leave any time he liked and didn't have to bother with lights or windows. Then Urban went back to straining credulity on the fallout topic.
"When you say you can't confirm something," asked a BBC reporter, "does this mean it's completely untrue?"
Is this your first time at a press conference?" said Urban.
What ails Poland is, as the Poles say, fatal but not serious. When I went to Interpress, the government agency that provides services to, and presumably keeps tabs on, foreign reporters, my minder immediately told this week's General Jaruzelski knee-slapper. The general is on a Polish TV quiz show. He has to answer 4 questions to win a prize. The host asks the first question.
"What happened in Poland in 1956?
Jaruzelski says,
"There were riots and strikes resulting from the justifiable anger of the working class."
"Correct," says the host. "What happened in Poland in 1970?
"There were riots and strikes," says Jaruzelski, "resulting from the justifiable anger of the working class."
"Correct," says the host. "What happened in Poland in 1980?
"There were riots and strikes resulting from the justifiable anger of the working class."
"Correct."
"And now for the 4th and final question. What will happen in Poland in 1987?
Jaruzelski thinks for a long time and finally says,
"I don't know, but I'll take a shot at it."
"Correct."
And telling the Poles I was writing about rock and roll turned out to be an inspired lie. It let me get official help to go have fun.
It gave me not only an excuse, but a mandate to be out prowling around at night, checking the dance halls and juke joints, and trying to find the wild get-down side of communism. A Nation's Fun will tell you more about that nation than anything except its jails. And if I got into enough fun, maybe I'd get into jail, too. Interpress hired a translator for me, who I'll call Sophia, a tall and pretty, bespectacled and intense girl, half head librarian and half fashion model. She spoke 5 languages.
"Will you want to interview many prominent figures in the field of popular music?"
she asked, looking bored. I said, "Sophia, there's only one way to cover this story. We have to get inside it. We have to experience it in the social context. We have to capture the gestalt, get the big picture. We've got to go out and drink too much and boogie."
"Your magazine pays you for this?"
she said. "Of course they do. I'm behind the Iron Curtain. This is dangerous. No agency of the U.S. government can help me now. I might be grabbed for a spy at any minute, held incommunicado, interrogated, days without sleep, drugs, electric shock. A story like this is bound to put me in touch with antisocial elements, people opposed to the government." Sophia began to giggle.
"Everyone in Poland is opposed to the government."
Sophia rounded up 2 friends, Mark and Tom, both Americans. Tom was a graduate student, studying Slavic languages in Warsaw. Mark was a college professor bumming around Europe on vacation. We drove in Tom's car and were promptly stopped by the police, who stop you all the time in Poland for no particular reason, like your mother did when you were a kid and trying to get out the back door. "Do you know why the police have dogs?" said Tom in English as he smiled pleasantly at the cop. "Somebody has to do the brain work." "Do you know why police cars have white stripes on the side?" Tom continued. "To help policemen find the door handles." Tom turned to me. Before Solidarity was crushed in 1981, these were all Russian jokes. The puzzled copper wanted to look in the trunk. Maybe we had the other 4,500 sleeping bags in there, or some plumbing fixtures. "A man goes into a bar," Tom told him, and tells the bartender, "I just heard a new policeman joke." A man who's sitting 3 stools away says, "Wait a minute, I'll have you know I'm a policeman." "That's all right," says the first man. "I'll speak very slowly and clearly." "Let's start with nightclubs," I said, as soon as the cop had given up on us. Sophia raised an eyebrow. "There's one called Carmina Wama, the Quarry," said Tom. The decor was budget mafia. Because of the name, I guess, the walls were covered with permastone house siding. There were little strips of disco lights around the dance floor, but they just flashed off and on. They didn't move around the room or change colors or anything. A bored combo, one singer, one guitar player, and a guy on the electric organ doing the rhythm, bass, and drum parts, played a Ramada Inn lounge arrangement of "I Got You, Babe," lyrics in memorized English. "Ug got you to hold me height. Bucket jute took us good night." A fat lady came out and sang "Feelings," also in English. A dance team gave a disco exhibition more reminiscent of Saturday Night Live than Saturday Night Fever. There was a mild strip act, the stripper winding up in the kind of 2-piece bathing suit worn by Baptist ministers' wives, but with sequins. The fat lady came back and sang "My Way." A very pretty girl in a harem outfit did a dance with a python. The disco team returned in 20s costume and did a 40s tap routine. The fat lady came back a third time and sang "Hello, Dolly." "Maybe they should put the snake in every act," said Mark. And the stripper finished the show doing "Dance of a Couple of Veils," with 3 large scarves and a blink of total nudity at the end. To grasp the true meaning of socialism, imagine a world where everything is designed by the post office, even the sleaze. There were some odd ducks in the audience. The women were all milkmaid types with too much hairspray. The men were dark and greasy, with Cadillac fin lapels on their suits and tie knots as big as their ears. "What kind of people go to nightclubs in Poland?" I asked Sophia.
"Whores and Arabs," she said.
"What do Poles really do for fun?"
"Drink,"
said Sophia. The next night, we went to a student club, Stodoa, the Barn. They do not have the knack of snappy nomenclature in Poland.
During the winter, Stodoa is the student union for Warsaw Technical University. The dance was held in the gym. The records were American or British, with an occasional ABBA cut that cleared the dance floor. This night, the kids were mostly high school age. They had dressed up, doing their best to find T-shirts, at least, in bright, clear, free-world colors. Some almost succeeded in looking American, in a Michael J. Fox way. The crowd was shy and square-acting. The boys danced in groups of boys. The girls danced together in pairs. And the dancing was terrible, stiff, and clunky, like spilling a can of Tinker Toys. There's a tragic lack of black people behind the Iron Curtain, which explains the dancing.
The only ethnic group we ever had was Jews, said Zofia, and they only dance in circles.
Several video monitors were suspended above the dance floor, showing Polish and European music videos and American cartoons. Whenever the brilliant hues of Porky Pig came on, the teenagers would dance in place and gape at the screens. Stodoa captured perfectly the sock-hop-on-wee of the early 1960s. One whiff of canoe and I would have time-warped completely and started doing the pony and the locomotion. Those freshman mixers were fun, I remember. Sort of. But I also remember how a bland future stretched out before us like an endless front yard full of crabgrass. There would be school and more school, job and more job, a wife or two, and indifferent kids of our own. Of course, we were crybabies. When a Polish kid says he's facing a boring and meaningless life, he's not just pulling his dad's chain at the dinner table. A few of the boys were sweat-faced and stumbling. Guess they got into the vodka, I said to Zofia. At least you don't have the drug problem we do in the West.
They are not drunk, she said. They are on heroin.
Poles, she explained, were the first to figure out how to extract opiates from poppy straw, the stubble that's left in the field after the poppy harvest. Now kids are doing it all over Europe. It's called the Polish method. Outside, two cops were manhandling a stoned teen.
Maybe if we stand here and look well-dressed, they will not beat him, said Zofia.
One cop had the face of a young Barney Fife from hell. Nasty pop eyes, a receding fish chin, and big, weak lips. Four or five of the stoned kid's friends interceded. First they reasoned. Then they yelled.
The police are scared, said Zofia. That is why they travel in pairs. Everyone hates the police.
The ugly cop pulled out his rubber truncheon and waved it. But he didn't do anything. Finally, the policeman walked away. The ugly cop called the kid a name.
That policeman is from a very low element, said Zofia.
You could tell from one word?
Yes.
Zofia, I thought this was a classless society.
You are kidding.
The third night, we went to Remont, Warsaw's only punk club. The kids didn't look very punky, more like it was a party game, where everybody had to do a quick impression of Patti Smith. Remont was, however, as smelly as CBGB's or the Mud Club ever used to be. The manager, Zagos Zazowicz, showed me a videotape about the Polish punk scene done by West German television. The punks all said the usual stuff. Everything is shit. Life is shit. This is shit. But they were matter-of-fact about it. These were foregone conclusions, not statements of rage. I couldn't, offhand, think of anything to ask Zagos. Does the Polish punk movement have any political significance? I said, and realized I'd put my foot in it. In a Marxist country, even a dank and stinky place like Remont needs some kind of official sanction, and Zagos must have some kind of official status. He looked miffed.
I notice a certain regularity in questions from the West, said Zagos. First, you're interested in punks. Usually your stories have two objectives, that punks are opposition to authority, breaking the rules that exist here. Also, your articles showed that there are no polar bears walking the streets.
He gave me a condescending smile.
There are moments when our country is very normal.
Hopelessly normal, I said. I notice your punks don't go in much for spiked hair and face tattoos.
They have some inhibitions, said Zagos. Also, we don't have the commercial products to do the hairstyles.
Zagos paused. He didn't want me to get a bad impression, but he didn't want me to think Polish punks were complete wimps either.
There was a smoke bomb a week ago, he ventured, and then he sighed. There are contradictions within the Polish punk scene. Remont is the only place they can come to express their rebellion against institutions, but once they get here, they enjoy rebelling against the institution of the club. The root problem is boredom. That's what made my generation rebel in the 60s in America, I said, trying to be nice. You know, we were bored with commercialism, bored with materialism. Zagos sighed again. They're rebelling here from lack of this. The two bands playing at Remont that